So last week we began the chapter, the eighth chapter of Sanhedrin, which is in Seder Nezikin, the order of damages, and we jumped right into the Mishnah regarding a stubborn and rebellious son. And we jumped into a little bit of the Mishnah and the Gemara. And for those of you in the Art Scroll, Volume 2, the Shamstein edition, it's on page 68B1, which I don't think they have other page numbers, so I can't tell you exactly. 68B1. So, in terms of the Mishnah and the bit of Gemara that we did, what I'd like to do is I'd like to run back through the Mishnah and Gemara I'd like to do that not by reading the entire translation out and out, but just run through the daf itself, the part that we did. I'd like to then just stop and see if we're clear to that point, and I'd also like to address just a couple of things that I think came out of the conversation last time, which led me to do a little bit of rethinking or learning or looking for other sources that could come to Meir Einenu, that could come to enlighten our eyes and minds. This is what I like to do sometimes in terms of the passage of study. But I'd like to be able to come back to the text with everybody's awareness that we are talking about a Mishnah and a Perek, a chapter that is, in essence, investigating more deeply a category that was within the realm of those to be stoned if they were sentenced to death. That we have, at the core of our tradition, punishments, arba mitot shel abei din, four death sentences, different kinds of death sentences that our Beit Din could mete out, and they are in essence done at the hands of judges. We had studied Gemara in the first half of the year about judges and how we arrange courts, and whether the system of justice is in our hands entirely, we know is not the case in our tradition, because we in essence have certain kinds of min hashamayim sentences to death from the hands of heaven in terms of sentences of death, which are generally called karet in the Torah, or death al yedei shamayim, at the hands of heaven, that were over and oppose the death sentences that human courts could actually mete out. In terms of those who would be stoned to death, yes, it said so directly in our Torah passage. And now the Gemara is going to take the majority of a chapter to go deeper into the Ben Sorer More, this stubborn and rebellious Ben. And it's going to now spend time there philosophically challenging us, the way that we heard some reaction last week. Could this really be part of our tradition to say that a child should be brought to such a place that he would be stoned at the hands of parents and a Beit Din deciding that he's been rebellious enough to actually have to be stoned to death? So that's the focal point. The Mishnah begins on 68b1. Ben Sorer More Mei Matai. When might one fall into the category of being a Ben Sorer More? I have to know exactly what that time period is. Rashi, up on top of the page, inside column, closest to the, some people call this the crease, right? This is the gutter, in printing terms. So closest to the gutter. Ben Sorer More v'chulei Seder Niskalin D'Tanya B'Prakin D'La'el. We have this in the order of those who are stoned, as we learned in the previous chapter. Misayim Hilchata V'Azil. Here we're going to finish the halachot, the Jewish laws, and we're going to go forward and talk about it vis-a-vis Gemara. We're going to do a little bit of Gemara about it. do Gemara, make Talmud, learn it out. Nase ben sorer umore misheyavi shtei sarot. He's made into, or he can become a ben sorer umore from the time that two pubic hairs arrive. And yes, someone said, oh, when he's bar mitzvah, he turns 13. You're right. You're within the culture of Chazal, within the culture of rabbis, if you say it's at the age of 13 and he has two pubic hairs. What do we call two pubic hairs that come, though, then, before the age of 13? Because it didn't say Ben Yud Gimel, 13 years old. I stopped us originally from saying 13 years old. Only to say that there's a question. What do you do if, in fact, that happens, that there's some physical maturity?
He's a katan.
He's still a katan because of the age limit, and it's called shuma. Any pubic hair at that point is called fuzz. Ve'ad shiyakiv zakan hatachton ve'lo ha'elyon. And from the time that he has two pubic hairs until the time that he has a full, if you will, beard or a wreath of hair around the member. Ela, you might be asking, why do I have zakan ha'tachton, this language of beard? Shidabru chachamim b'lashon nikia. That the rabbi spoke in a language that is clean.
At that time, in the Bible, it says the word Devavah shows, appears many, many, many times. So they could specifically spell out the topology of the body part and say Devavah. So there is no reason to say Zakan Tachton or Zakan Elyon. And I'm surprised why they are not using the biblical word.
So I brought Steinsaltz because I like Rabbi Steinsaltz's work on the Gemara, and there's always a little bit of a note sometimes when you have issues like this. That the rabbi spoke in a quote-unquote clean language. At the beginning of the tractate of Passover, of Psachim, the Paschal offerings, in plural, yesh diun mimushach b'yachas l'shon nikiyah. There's a wonderful kind of diun, there's a discussion of what is this Lashon Nikiyah she'mishtamshim ba'chachamim that the sages used during their discussions. V'heru she'af ha'Torah mishtameshet b'Lashon Nikiyah, that even the Torah uses a Lashon Nikiyah. In other words, when it says what? When it talks a little bit about Erva, they're saying a little bit more straightforwardly, but when it talks about maybe if someone's going to be cursed, they talk about him being Baruch in the prophets, like, oh, blessed is he. So the Torah sometimes, or the Tanakh, our sacred scriptures, used a little bit of clean language because of some instances over there where instead of saying someone's cursed, they said he's blessed. And other such examples as given over there. The heru she'af ha'Torah mishtamesh b'lashon nikiyah. B'lashon nikiyah zu lo rak she'ena kor'a dvarim she'be'erva bishmam. And it's not that clean language is only used when it's talking about some kind of sexual matter. Ela af nosim acherim shera'u behem ganai misuyam. But rather when the rabbi saw that it was a subject that deserved a little bit of cleaning up of the language, such as what? Chazir tzara'at va'od. In other words, when it was talking about a leper, let's say, and they wanted not to totally use such language as to be entirely either straightforward or offensive. So it's obviously a note that the rabbis have to themselves to say, we have to have a discussion about this, why we would use such language. And we, in fact, use that language so that we can be somewhat naki. Continuing forward. Shenemar. Shenemar being somewhat of a technical term in addition to being a way that the rabbi's parlance works. Shenemar is going to introduce what?
Approved text.
A verse from Scripture. Ki yeh le'ish ben. I have a verse to bring you to prove my legal position. It is a halachic midrash. Halachic midrash First I learn ben velo bat. A child, a ben, a son, a male child, and not a girl. Bat, in this case, being brought in essence, seemingly from the outside. Did I ever think to say that my, what's called a hava amina in the Mishnah, did the Mishnah purport that a bat, a young girl, could actually fit the category? No, it didn't. At the beginning of this Mishnah, we didn't ever say bat soreret. We didn't say it was a daughter. I just happened to have this as part of the Midrashic tradition that somebody quoted in the Beit Midrash. And it gives me a way to further make smaller, lima'et, to make smaller the category of those who fit into it, without even having to refute an argument that she could fit in. So the fact that I bring this drush and not another on the pasuk, and the Mishnah was built with it, is inherently a move to, right from the start, limit my category. And then I also learn ben velo ish, a son and not a man. Now what's the problem? You might think that that means that a ben is not an ish. And in terms of legal parlance, that would make me equivocate the term ben to katan, a son to a youth, let's say. But that's really not what we're saying. We're just going to say that it's a ben and not an ish. We have to understand what that means legally. Because what? Katan patur shaloba lichlal mitzvot. Because we already know, in essence, that a katan, a person of minor category, not of legal age, is not required to do any of the mitzvot. So,
what does that mean by ish?
That
is
so
that in the Gemara?
Ish, we said, is one, last week, just to go over it again, is one of four terms that I can use for a person of legal age. But what it actually means is going to become clearer to us through the actual learning out that this passage of Gemara does. Because exactly, that's the question. Are you telling me that that ish is different than a ben who has already reached legal status? In other words, now I have two terms for someone of legal status. I've got the term ben, and I've got the term ish. So what are the four terms in Torah for a person who has full status of legal status? I have. First of all, ish. A person, a man. I have enosh, one of humanity. I have Adam, that harkens back to the first person on the face of the earth. And I have Gever, which from the word hero comes, Gibor. These four terms are used throughout the Gemara. Now, according to some understandings of their force, different words are associated with different things. We're going to see in a minute why people think the term ish is associated with a person's physical power. Physical meaning not just strength like this, but physical as in, I can now sire children. Because ish has the power to be molid, has the power to bear children, whereas this ben will not have that power. And is samuch l'gevurato. Yeah, I would say that in terms of halachic status of men's categories, those are the four, but you're right. If you use the term nefesh to say about a person and have a case where you would have a person goes and does this or that, that term could definitely be used. Nefesh. And that comes from also that beginning part of the Torah where God breathed into the life, the nefesh. Especially in the Torah, that term is a person or body. Already we see in Talmudic times, there's a little bit of thinking about that term, even somewhat spiritually. Because the poetics of nefesh in the Psalms change somewhat.
The reason I said that is because nefesh, I think, is used very frequently in Leviticus, okay, when it occurs, so in a legal, strictly legal sense. So I was wondering where it fit in.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point to say. It's in Torah, for sure, that way. Poetically moves, and then by this time you could either have it be a person or you could even have it be some sense of spiritual life. Okay, so everybody good with the Mishnah? So the Gemara begins. Katan minalan patur. How do we know that, or where from, is a katan patur? Questions the Gemara pretty innocently. Minalan? You ask, where from a katan is exempt? A minor is exempt? Is that a question that you're really asking me, in other words? Why is it said in such a surprising way? Kidakatane tama. The Mishnah actually just said it very explicitly. A katan is patur. So why do I need anything else other than this Mishnah to tell me that this katan is patur? Shelo ba lichlal mitzvot. And I even have a reason. That they're not obligated for any of the mitzvot in a legal sense. The two. And if you want further proof, and you want me to tell you how crazy your question sounds, Hecha ashkechan the anesh hakatuv the hacha v'bayi krala miftere. Are you saying that we have any place in the Torah that actually comes and assumes that a katan is obligated or required to do a mitzvah and then came to actually exempt him? See the logic of the argument? You, in essence, made a hava amina. You, in essence, created an assumption or started your question with an assumption that there's at some point some obligation for a minor to be obligated to something. But we don't have that. And we have a straightforward limud, a learning out, of the text right here in our Mishnah that says, and a katan is patur. So, we don't really need a limud to prove the point. A lot of times the rabbis absolutely require a limud to prove a point. When you have a minalan, it's not often that you have the question on the minalan. Where do we know this from? Minalan? You're asking, where do we know this from? That's the entire project of Chazal. To find proofs within verses. If nothing else, that's a major project. To know that the Holy Writ has at its core the message and the way to build out the legal system. That's why the question is so interesting here. Anan hachika amarinan. This is what it really means to say, though. There is some merit to this kind of discussion going forward. Atu ben sore rumore al chatao nerag. Are you saying that in fact the ben sorer or more, whatever category of person that is, ben sorer or more, are you saying that because of his sins he's really going to be killed? Because of davka, those sins? See, the Gemara is saying, look at the Rashi, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 lines down. Or three lines down it starts. Atu ben sora amore al shem chata'o neharag. And there's a question mark there. It's in the, after the gimel mem, after the big gimel mem in the Rashi. It's in the narrow part of the Rashi. After the gimel mem, three lines down. Denibaye bar onshin. Are you learning out? Must we say that he's actually deserving of punishment right now, especially the punishment of stoning? וכי מה חטא שיהרוג מבני שאכל טרטמר בשר ושתה חצי לו יין? How do you have such a willingness to punish him to death if he ate this measure of meat and drank that much of a slug of wine? In other words, my question is, shouldn't we say that our punishment is really overdone by asking what we think about the katan having no obligation and the Torah never having to tell us that he's really not responsible? I kind of put you in this sense of asking who's really responsible for what. Do we say about this Ben Sora More that he should be brought because of his not listening and his eating and drinking? Does that make any sense to us? The Mishnah made total sense to me. A katan patur. Ben Sora More makes no sense to me. So that's why the Gemara now has to find another reason why this person, this Ben Sora More, is in fact Chayav Mitah, obligated to a death penalty of stoning. And Rashi gives away what the Gemara says inside this Rashi. Al Shem Sofo Nerag Kedemefarish B'Sholhei Parakim. And it's on the for the sake of what he will do in his end that he is punished to death. And not here. But that's what our Gemara says. So sometimes Rashi steals the thunder of the Gemara. It's interesting to see when Rashi precedes what the Gemara will tell you later and when it does not. Sarah Kamin is the Hebrew University professor, one of the professors par excellence on Rashi's entire approaches to both the study of Chumash and the study of Gemara. And I believe it was she who wrote that Rashi's notion of bringing you simple sense sometimes lets him reveal to you what the story says further, so that you have, in essence, the whole narrative in your mind's eye, so that you can hold the text together. Back to the Gemara. By the way, so I have a little system with actually being on a page of Gemara in the Hebrew that I want to share with you just for a moment that has always worked for me if you want to follow with your finger on the line of the Hebrew page. So when I start a page of Gemara, the word Ben, everybody see the word Ben who's got the book in front of them? Right? So I'm on the Vilna, so I'm doing it with this art school that we said, many people said, obviously if you're holding something else, you could do it with anything that you're holding with. But I make the line Ben, line number one. I then go down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I label line 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, starts so rare. 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 starts Zakan. 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 starts Mibaye. 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, Deraba. So I have now a little bit of a system of, I'm going to bring you into the Gemara in line, what have you. So for those of us who have Surat Hadath Vilna, the form of the page of Vilna, sometimes if you want to be with me in that page, I'll try to use this numbering system. Every 5 lines, I put a number by actually right in my Gemara as we go. I'll go back to the translation, by the way, with things that we have not gotten to today. But I wanted to run through again this whole notion of what we did learn in this sense as a little bit of chazarat, of review. So, what does it say after the question, line 9 and 10? Anan hachi kamrinan atu ben soler moroi al chata onerag. Is he really killed or sentenced to death for that which he did by way of his sins of eating and drinking? Those of you who remember, we read last week the verses from Torah. Because he overate and was a glutton and he drank and he was not listening to his parents' discipline, that's why they brought him to the elders of the city, and the elders of the city sentenced him to this stoning death if his mother and his father said that he's indeed a son who is rebellious and stubborn. Oh, the Gemara says, no, it's not for the sins of eating and drinking. Al Shem Sofo Neherag. It is for what he will ultimately do that he is executed to death.
Preemptive killing.
I think we did.
The
Kevan de Al Shem Sofo Neherag Afilu Katan Nami. And because we say that it's upon what will be in the end, we should also say that a minor person should be held accountable to that, since we could identify in the minor that he would also have the same end. V'od ben v'lo ish. And I also see from the verse that you quoted, it does say the word ben. And I'm willing to say that it's the minor, v'lo ish. Katan mashma. In fact, we learn that the katan should be held accountable. So what do we say? Gemara comes to refute it. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. We have a teaching in the name of Rav Yehuda Amar, who says in the name of Rav, the Amar Kra v'chi hiye l'ish ben. When it says that we have an ish who has a ben, we're really saying that means a ben samuch l'gvura to shel ish. We're now going to get very specific about what this ben category is. It's a ben, a child who is very close to his full power as an ish. And that's where this ish comes in. The ish has the full power in potential, can inseminate a woman, but it doesn't mean a katan. It doesn't mean a katan. And
does it mean an ish or not quite an ish?
So that's the thing. It means that the category of ish, you thought the category of ish might have been the person who comes into age and has two pubic hairs and now he's ish l'chol davar. Right? Legally, he really is. You know that from other limudim in the Gemara. Except when it comes to the category of ben sorer moreh, I say it's a ben v'lo ish. But that doesn't mean it's a katan, because I knew from the Mishnah that the katan can't be a ben sorer moreh. So it must be someone from two pubic hairs of age.
Well, I'm totally confused, really. I mean, so this, if the age of Tusa Arot means this ben is already Kolel Mitzvot, in other words, if Tusa Arot is a shorthand for Bar Mitzvah,
it is.
Then who cares? Then he's subject to the mitzvot, so he's subject to the mitzvot.
Unless we're trying to fit him into the category of ben sorer moreh. And in that case, I say that he can only be ben sorer moreh when he's a ben of an ish, and until the time he has a full zakan around his aver, around his member, and I've now limited his responsibility for certain mitzvot. And during that time, yes, we can call him that, ben sorer moreh, but I'm now going to make his ish status a little bit different than being a ben at this time period in his life.
To simplify, is there an age, like a few years, where not all the mitzvot are required? There's the pubic hair or the bar mitzvah, and then there is an ish, and there's a...
So this is an interesting fact in the history of Hebrew law. I brought you today a piece. Turn the page over. We'll start on the back. Okay, look down about halfway down the page in contrast. All right? In contrast. In contrast, the rabbis fix the age when children attain their majority. Everybody with me there? And were said to have legal capacity for certain acts as 12 years for a girl and 13 years for a boy when they were called gedolim. They were liberated from the control of their father. A girl under 12 was known as a kitana, a small girl. Between 12 and 12 and a half years, she was known as a na'ara. But once she had reached 12 and a half years, she was designated as a Bogeret. Now, stop for a second. Meir's question just now is, did we have statuses that people were only half responsible? When it comes to young girls, the answer is yes. We go from stage Kitana, small girl, to Na'ara, this youthful girl, to Bogeret, an age of majority. When it comes to boys, the answer is not like that. We have a child with legal capacity was designated a Gadol, period. So you went from being a Katan to a Gadol. Except here, we know that a Ben Sorer Umore is liable because his parents say he's obligated to do certain things. He's not doing them now. I'm bringing him to the court, and I want this juvenile stoned to death. That's where we have to see that the rabbis were willing to, in terms of clearing up any of that confusion of status, the rabbis were willing to say, oh, but there's one category that doesn't work exactly like that, but it's not a category that all kids fall into, like the notion of being a na'ara for a girl. It's that you could be fit into this category, even though you're, quote-unquote, considered of majority age for many, many of the mitzvot, all the mitzvot ase, the mitzvot lo ta'ase. You only can fit into the category of ben sorer umore from this time period to this time period. Doesn't mean you're less obligated to all the other mitzvot. It means that your behavior now makes you have a legal status of ben sorer umore, and that your parents could drag you to the court at the gates of your city and bring you to the elders. They want to limit that in their philosophy to a short period of time. From Tusa, I wrote, from the time two pubic hairs come until the time that this fuller pubic hair comes in, and they'll work even further to limit that based on some legal maneuvering that we'll see in the Gemara.
Part of the confusion appears to be that some periods are fixed by the calendar, so to speak. In other words, it's an objective test. So let's say 13 is bar mitzvah. So you could be very childish when you're 13, but when you reach 13, it doesn't matter what your physical development is or even your mental development. That's an objective test. This seems to be, at least for the moment, speaking about a subjective test for the child, for the Ben. Like, you have to inspect and see if there are two sorot. Maybe the child is 11. Maybe the child is 15.
If we didn't have the other places in the Gemara where it said, we know we're talking about a 13-year-old child, you'd be right. And the Mishnah didn't really say at 13. It just says from two sorot. But since the rabbi's parlance is that two sarot, two hairs, is when someone turns 13, we now call whatever we find there, right, pubic hairs, as opposed to the fuzz that was from before then.
So are you saying that this means that when it says two sarot, it means 13?
It does.
I thought they had to conclude 12.
For a girl, it's 12
but,
to 12 and a half. For a boy, yes. That's the spot.
Rabbi, what strikes me is that the qualities of the child or young man are not about his behavior in terms of particular laws, his vote or otherwise, but his malleability. So the qualities are rebelliousness and something like stubbornness. And those have to do with the relationship to the parents. So it makes sense to me that you would define this phase of judgment as having to do with a period where the child or young man is still responsive or might be to the parents or not. And that's maybe why this is so critical. They're, you know, they're not saying he's a murderer, or I think, as someone pointed out last week, it's not about drinking or eating. It's about his malleability or not.
Right.
I don't understand the use of this.
Yeah, definitely it's a time period where he's malleable. He's definitely... The question is, can we really make this judgment about his end? And the Gemara is saying, are we really thinking that this time in life, he's not going to have a little bit of rebelliousness in him?
Right, what I mean, though, is that he's rebellious, but going against his parents, or he's stubborn against his parents or what they're trying to teach him. And that's what it's about.
Right.
So by definition, it's that period.
There's a big piece in here that's just about that notion of the parental relationship with his child. For sure.
He's between the 13 and Shtei Sa'arot until Karov LeGvurato, when he becomes, so to speak, a dal, he's Ben Sorer Umuret. What happened if he doesn't live in all at all?
Where he lives doesn't make a difference to the rabbis.
His parents are not connected with him. They cannot.
Yeah.
Where is the blame? Where parents can bring the blame if he lives with
him? By the way, again, we talked a little bit about this whole notion of ancient law and where parents have responsibility and where they don't last time. So I brought, turn the page back over. No, sorry, go back to the other side. Up to the paragraph above the one I started on. Moreover, a person in Roman law remained under the potestas of his father, however old he himself was, so long as his father survived. Under Roman law, the male head, the pater familias, had the power of life and death over his children, mostly exercised in deciding whether or not they would be permitted to survive after birth, an authority to administer property on their behalf, whatever their age, to punish them corporally or to sell them into slavery and to conclude and terminate marriages for them. Beryl Rawson argued that the father's power was somewhat limited in reality by a son setting up his own household, although even here he might be dependent on his father's allowance. This is all scholarly debate. Paul Vane pointed out that in a pre-industrial society such as Rome, the heavy mortality rate removed most fathers at a relatively early age, thereby giving their sons their freedom. In addition, under the Roman emperors and the Christian era, not only were the father's rights further restricted, but in Egypt, the Roman concept of patria potestas was so whittled down that it amounted to little more than guardianship. Thus, sons could later dispute an unwelcome choice of marriage partner, and the father's right to disrupt harmonious marriages was relinquished, while adult children could keep their earnings, particularly if they were derived from military service. In contrast, the rabbis fixed the age. In other words, that's where we read before. So the contrast of the rabbinic system actually leaving the father out of the total responsibility and, in this sense, finding the way to limit this time that a son could be categorized as a rebellious child vis-a-vis if the relationship kept going on in such a way that even looked like what it was before, that's the legal move that they're doing here. But they have to deal with it because it says in Deuteronomy, I have this category of child, I have parents, I have Roman law, I have ancient Egyptian law that has some sense of patriarchal power in terms of the connection. We added the mother where no one else did, and that was a little bit of a tikkun in there somehow, a fix of adding another voice in Torah, or we heard that from heaven, whichever way you look at that, and we see that our system stands over and against all these other systems where control for the Romans and the Greeks was everlasting to the point where unless the father died, some of these children could be, in essence, terminated by way of financial realities, by way of marriages. How it worked in the courts and whether or not they would accept the father's claims are some of the same questions, yes, that we asked about who would accept these parents' claims regarding this child. Wouldn't they send them back and say, you know, hey, there's a good school for your kid. Get them out of the house. You obviously can't live together. But on the other hand, given the right venue, some courts become courts of illustration, is the term that I've read in legal philosophy, where they want to say, we're willing to carry out that law. The rabbis wanted not a very long time where this law could be carried out and illustrated. So, that's the force of this, and, yeah?
Sorry, but I'm trying to get this picture clear. If the child's behavior, so long as he's a katkan, does not put him in the position of being a Ben Sorer Moreh, but he can obtain that category only during the perhaps narrow period at the start of puberty until he becomes obligated under our law to specific response.
Just let me fix one piece to your question. When he starts puberty at the age of 13, even if he started puberty before, because he's now legally required.
It would appear that the action of the parents has more to do with the relationship with the community than with the relationship with the child. They have to accept the fact that he's a stubborn child.
Mm-hmm.
And disobedient.
Mm-hmm.
So long as he's a child. And in fact, they probably could accept it for the rest of their life and his life.
Right.
But once he becomes of a certain age, he's going to go out into the community. And now the community has to deal with him because he's now a autonomous individual and a member of the society.
Right.
Is that what
they're
saying? Because you would say, hey, the kid is 11 years old and he's impossible. You know, we can't cope with him anymore. They can't do anything.
The question of whether or not we're dealing with they can't do anything and he's going to go out into society and he really won't take a trade and he's just going to be a beggar versus I really see in him sociopath tendencies. And, you know, where does that really, where does the societal impact really stem, and is that the reason why we have the category of ben so rare amore to begin with, is really a question, foundational question, vis-a-vis the code of law in Deuteronomy. The fact that we want to see some way of dealing with juvenile offenders in our system, and we have the Gemara here philosophizing about delimiting the time when we have to actually do the stoning that the Torah calls for, or that even was permissible by the courts in rabbinic times, is the philosophy that obviously we need to think very deeply about whether or not we want this punishment to be meted out by our courts, right?
This may have been taken up in a previous session with just a visitor tonight, but it seems to me that the discussion that I've heard thus far doesn't seem to take account of the severity of the offense. Seems to be a one-size-fits-all characterization that the boy is both a drunkard and otherwise wayward. Isn't there a question of fact to be concerned with the extent to which his behavior is violative of social standards?
You know, sometimes for Chazal, rules of evidence and who brought what charges were not that important. Unlike today's system, maybe. Evidentiary procedure here is that the parents bring him to court.
And there's a presumption.
There is. And so we're dealing with a unique case. And we're going to talk legally about what was ordained by Torah to respond to it. And we as rabbis really don't feel like we have to totally allow for it and tell people here's step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 how to achieve it. We're going to talk about this to the point where we're going to create a system whereby we really question it. That really is what they're saying, and what kind of evidence could we really have is an inherent question underneath it all. Because
He would say that the child says one thing and the parent says another. But, you know, I know at the end of
you
the story...
You can't testify for yourself.
I know at the end of the story is that the penalty wasn't exacted, so I'll just content myself with that.
Right.
But it seems to me that what's happening here is that the rabbis are trying to make society, in general, responsible for preserving the order of society by protecting itself, from a future horror in the story. So, if it was an adult, if it was a niche, society itself would take care of it. But when we start getting into these issues of people that are minors or almost adults or in this area, it's the parents, that have the obligation. What happens in the case of the son? What happens in the case of somebody that's six, seven, 8 year old that society has to be protected.
He's excused. He's excused. No, absolutely. He's excused. The father's not responsible for the damage, and we just push on from there. Honestly, that's the real answer vis-a-vis the system that we've created, but it's true that they're trying to protect society.
But the converse is, and it's upsetting, that parents who just don't want to deal with their child can just have this easy out. You know, it's I find it
well,
really amazing.
That's not exactly the case. And again, I'll go back to this side. Unlike in the Hellenistic schools, I'm now sideways, unlike the Hellenistic schools, which catered to a small elite in the cities and discriminated against the bulk of the rural population, the Jewish elementary school became universal. After the destruction of the temple in 70 CE, the new Greek-style school spread slowly in Palestine at the end of the 1st century and throughout the 2nd century, leaving large sections of the population outside the educational system. In Babylonia, where the elementary schools were based on the Palestinian model, progress was even slower. Many scholars have documented the contemptuous remarks uttered by the sages during the period against the Amei HaAretz, mostly rural inhabitants, but also including some city merchants in this period, who were ignorant of the Torah. Down to the bottom of the paragraph, anyone who has sons and does not bring them up to study the Torah, you know, is basically an Amei HaAretz, a person of the rural landscape and not educated. What we see, though, is that there's a push towards, and we mentioned this the last time as well, holding parents to the obligation of actually educating their children and the community to the obligation of providing for those schools. And by doing so, we thought we could create a society that all people held one another responsible for. And a lot of the midrash, the agadic material that says the world exists for the breadth of school children and all this kind of thing, is because of the desire to meet the challenge of creating an orderly society. The way that they did it oftentimes is to say to you, I'm going to now learn this through, and the holy writ that you take as seriously as I do, we're going to learn it from inside, which I'd like to do further. Va'od. Ki ben, v'lo ish katan mashma. So we say that the minor can be punished. So the Gemara now answers, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Rav, Amar Krav, Chi Yehiyele Ish Ben, as scripture states, and if there will be a man, to a man a wayward and rebellious son, which could mean, and if a wayward and rebellious son becomes a man, Ben Hasmuch L'Gevurato Shel Ish, this says it's a son who has nearly attained the strength of a man, a boy who sins soon after becoming an adult, in other words. So that is the limud of Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav. Important to remember it, because the Gemara wants to now explore that. The Mishnah stated, Ba'ad she'yakiv zakan ha'tachton, this is where we left off last time, Tane Rabbi Chiya, ad she'yakiv atara, until hair grows around the pubic area like a crown. Ki atarav dimi amar, when Rav Dimi arrived in Babylonia, he said, Hakafat gid v'lo hakafat beitzim. The Braita refers to a pubic hair that grows around the base of the aver of the male member, not around the scrotum, the testicles. Now, onward. Amar Rav Chista. Chista, katan shaholid, if a minor fathered a son, ein beno nase ben sorer more, his son cannot become a ben sorer more. Why can't a katan a person who's a minor have a son, but he can't become someone who falls into this category of ben sorer more? Shenemar, because it says specifically in the verse, ki yihye le'ish ben, when a man has a son, meaning a man of full legal status. But if it was a katan, a minor, who had a son, Rav Chista says, can't fall into this category of ben sorer more, because that's the way the Torah is written. Le'ish ben, a person of full legal status. By specifying that the father is a man, scripture implies that a son born to an adult man can become a ben sorer more, below leven ben, and not to a ben, and not to a ben, not to a child. Now, hold right there. Let's do a little bit of Rishonim work. What's the muddiness that comes in with this line in the Gemara? I just said that Rav Chista's teaching was a katan sheholid, a katan that sires a child. And then the drush was, but you can't have a ben who has a ben. But what's the Mishnah doing? It's using the term ben, not as a katan. See the muddiness? Let me go through it once more. Rav Chista's teaching is a katan, a minor who's not legally responsible for mitzvot. A minor can have a child, obviously, by Rav Chista. Oh, there's another point to put on the table. A minor just was said that could sire a child. That's A. If he has a child, then is that child potentially a ben sorer more ever? No, because it's a katan. Le'ish ben, because the verse from the Torah says, when a man of majority shall have a son. And lo, le'ben ben. Oh, it would have been so much cleaner if it would have said, and lo le'katan ben. It would have been so much cleaner if it said, not for a katan to have a child. But since it says le'ben ben, there's a little bit of muddiness, because I'm using the term ben up above, not as a minor. I'm saying a ben is someone of mature age who's just not able yet to have a full set of pubic hair around his aver, around his member. So, okay, so one of the Rishonim says, stop making such muddy waters. Stop making it so muddy. What he meant was that a minor, who we call the katan, at the end of the Mishnah, when that minor has a child, that child can't become a ben sorer more. Don't get caught up in the language, in other words. I can use the term ben as a minor, just like you're using it for ben sorer more. Ben sorer more is what I'm talking about.
You might define an individual, a male who can have, who can honor a child, as an ish.
That's exactly the thing. So, yes, that's true, but Rav Chista says a katan shaholit. So remember now, Rav Chista is holding that there is a minor who can have a child, even though we don't say that minor is ever responsible for all the mitzvot, like an ish. And that minor's child can never be a ben sorer more.
I understand what they're saying, but the flip side is, if he fathered a child, regardless of his age, he's an ish. He's not a katan.
Okay, only by way of defining ish as someone who has the power to sire. But we're not really calling him an ish yet because he's not 13, and we're going to keep this category clean.
But the definition of sorer or more, you need to be 13 with two pubic hair. So the younger kid of the katan, 13 years later, the katan that had that kid is already 13 years older. So he's already an ish.
It's just for them, it's very clear. You don't have to make jumping jacks about how many years and how many.
So they want to have marriage in very early age, so they will never have pencil and white.
Sometimes that's the case, by the way. Sometimes in the olden days, says some of the commentary, you had kids who were 8, 9 years old who could have children.
That was discussed.
He says
there's a whole discussion.
A and B, it's in the commentary here. Let's push forward. In the text. Hi, mi baile. The Gemara is now going to say about Rav Chista's position. Hi, mi baile, lichid the Rav Yehuda amar Rav. But this verse is needed for the exposition that Rav Yehuda quoted in the name of Rav. So that's why I have to now be someone who holds a little bit of remembering what that limud was. Right? What did Rav Yehuda amar Rav say? He said that verse, in the way it's stated, ki yihyeh le'ish ben, when a man has a son, his drush on that verse was ben hasamuch legevurato shelish. That means it's a category of a child of age who does not yet have the full power of the ish to sire a child. Rav Chista used the verse to exclude the son of a minor. The argument over whether a pasuk, a verse from the Torah, is needed to make a certain midrash is one of the hermeneutical ways in the Gemara where we either yes prove our point we could be not able to prove our point, or we can be told both understandings hold based on some element of the verse that we're going to pick out. In fact, that's what happens in our Gemara. Let's look at it. The Gemara answers, Im kein, if it were so that this verse teaches only Rav's law that Rabbi Yehuda brought, Lemakra ki yihyeh ben le'ish. Let the verse be worded in a different way. Instead of saying le'ish ben, it would say yihyeh ben le'ish, when there's a son to a man, instead of when there to a man is a son. When a son will become a wayward and rebellious man. Mentioning son before man, this would clearly have indicated Rav's exposition, the earlier drash. My ki yihyeh le'ish ben, what does scripture really come to mean when it states if he will become a man, a wayward and rebellious son, or if to a man there will be a wayward and rebellious son, placing man before son, shma mina lichad Rav Chista. We learn from this that scripture is also teaching the law of Rav Chista, that the boy must have been fathered by an adult. So what is the notion there? What are they really seeing? That they're seeing from the way the Torah uses words and a letter, you can learn two midrashic understandings. The first one that Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Rav, and the second one that Rav Chista said. And how do I know that it's just about an extra letter? And it's not just only about the word order. This is where Rashi becomes really a friend. It's the Lamed. Rashi sometimes has a different manuscript of the Gemara in front of him than the manuscript of Gemara that we're working with on a page of the Vilna Shas. I'm sure you've encountered this over the years. And Rashi says, in this case, if you look down in the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8th wide line of Rashi, Hachi Gar Sinan, we have a different version of this Gemara. Im Kain, if that was the case that I could only learn one of the drashot, Lemakra, let the verse say, Ki Yihyeh Ben Ish, dropping the Lamed. When a ben becomes an ish, when that child becomes this wild man. But since I have the lamed, and it says when there will be la ish to a man, this kind of ben, I can learn two things. One, that it's about the limiting of the fact that I can only have a ben sora more, a rebellious and stubborn son, to an ish, and the other, that I have a unique way of understanding a ben, who's not a full ish in his power to sire children yet, and that's Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav. So I now can have both. If we didn't have the Rashi to tell us that he had a version of the Gemara that excluded the Lamed for us to kind of peer in to the fact that the verse might have been written even differently than it was in Torah without the Lamed, I might have thought it was only about the word order. But since Rashi had a different version and he dropped the Lamed, had a version that kind of rewrote the Torah.
Yeah, but his verse is from the Torah, not from... Sometimes the Rashi... I thought the Gir said that we have sometimes different... The Rashi is about what Rashi said or what other commentators said.
No, it's Davka about the potential of what the Torah might have said in this case, not what the Torah said. The potential, the Hava Amin, I might have thought that the verse should read like this, but in fact the Torah's verse reads like this. And so the indication here that they had some playfulness with the notion of even thinking that the Torah could have been written differently without a certain letter comes through in the way that Rashi approaches the whole question. And his Gemara, that's what it was. So I'm going to be able to learn both of those limudim. Now, I'm on 68b3. The Gemara asks, "Ve'ema kule lahachi hu de'ata," but say that the verse comes entirely for this. That what? To teach Rav Chista's law. What indication is there that the verse teaches Rav's law as well? The Gemara is going to answer this. Im kein, if it were so that the verse teaches only Rav Chista's law, what's Rav Chista's law again? Got to hold these things in our mind.
That a minor can have a child.
That a minor can have a child, and that child is what?
Never ben
Sorer More. Im Cain, if it were so that the verse teaches only Rav Chista's law, Neimakra ben Ish. The verse should have stated, when a son of a man is a wayward and rebellious son. By mentioning son first, the Torah could have written one less letter than it did, and would have not had to have the Lamed there. My Le Ish ben, but what do we get from the fact that we have the extra Lamed? Shema Minat Tarte. We actually can learn both things, and therefore Rav Chista's drush stands, and so does Rav Yehuda B'Shem Rav. So both learnings actually stand. Now Rav Chista obviously turns the Gemara. Rav Chista thinks a minor can physically father a child. A minor. So the Gemara is now going to explore that for a moment. Because we're interested, A, in anatomy. We're interested in development of human beings. We're interested in whether or not that affects our whole understanding of our entire legal system. And we're going to bring you to a case that has nothing to do with capital punishment for a minute so that we can figure out whether or not a minor really can have children.
So what's the inference about the age of the woman who bore this child?
I don't know. You see an inference here?
No, that's the whole point. There is none. I'm asking you.
I don't think that there was an inference.
There's no discussion of the age of the mother.
It's obviously someone who's of childbearing age.
Right, but we want to know if she's a...
She could be 9 years old.
A Nahira?
Nara.
A Nahara? Or a... She could be a Kachana? A Nahara? But is she under her father's authority still? Or should we say that this is a case of adultery?
I think it goes back to the Torah. I think it says, if a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, that will not. It doesn't say if a woman. And then it doesn't come, hearken to the voice, so they're only worried about the ages and the function of the father, physiological function of the father.
But the interesting part is that it's unmentioned who's bearing the child. That's interesting to me.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I get there. I'm going to rethink the question as we go forward to see if I saw... You know, I'll try to see if I saw in a Rashi what the actual case and the age is. But meanwhile, in order to understand this next section of inquiry, we have to understand a certain story in the Torah, or a certain set of facts in the Torah, case law, about a situation as in source number one on the handout that I gave you tonight. We see in the Torah in Parshat Naso in Bamidbar, in the section of Numbers called Naso, that verses 8 through 10 come into our immediate understanding. They have to be understood here in order to understand the next foray of the Gemara's legal discussion. So, verse 8, Ve'im ein le'ish go'el l'hashiv ha'asham elav, ha'asham ha'mushav l'adonai l'kohen, milavad el ha'kipurim asher yechaper bo'alav. If the man has no kinsman to whom restitution can be made, the amount repaid shall go to the Lord for the priest, in addition to the ram of expiation with which expiation is made on his behalf. That verse in and of itself requires us a little backstory. The backstory is as follows. There's a convert. And this Ger Tzedek, righteous convert, loans to a Jew some money. That money is owed the ger, and he says, I don't owe you any money. The ger takes him to court, and he, in the way that we made very, very righteous and legally binding oaths in the ancient world, he makes an oath that he doesn't owe him the money. But it's a davar sheker. It's an absolute lie.
Shivuat
sheker. By making that lie, he's now not only responsible for the money and on top of that payment, but for an offering to expiate his guilt. The ger dies. The guy comes back and says, oh, I must make restitution. I must pay back my loan. I must bring my offering. If there is no kinsman to whom restitution can be made, according to our verse, where does the money go? To the Kohen. If the person is a ger, do we say that there's any kinsmen to worry about? Who has kinsmen to worry about? Whose kinsmen do we have to go discover if really he has any kinsmen in order to go repay them? Who can we just pay the Kohen for and be done by way of expiating our guilt? And what does it teach us about whether or not a minor can have children? That's the background that we need for the next foray of Gemara. So the Gemara says like this. Oof, Liga de Rabba, and Rav Chista disagrees with Rabba. I'm on page 68b3. Rav Chista disagrees with Rabba, de Amar Rabba, for Rabba said the following. Katan eino molid. A minor cannot father a child. Right? How do we know Rav Chista held that a minor could? Because he said, if a minor has a child, he can't be a ben sora amore. So now we have a machloket, a disagreement between Chista and Rava. Now Rava cites a scriptural source for his statement. Shenamar, as it says in the scriptures, Ve'im ein la'ish goel. If a person has no relative to whom the debt can be returned, he shall pay it to the Kohen. That's the verse we just read from Bamidbar. V'chi yesh lecha adam b'Yisrael she'en lo goel. Do you really have any Jewish person in the world who has not a relative? Every Jewish person has a relative in the world. You're part of one big mishpacha and you can't get away. It is assumed and noted that you really have a relative. So this is an absolute kind of holding. She'en lo golim. Ein lecha adam. I'm in the Rashi, three lines up, the bottom part of the Rashi. She'en lo golim. Ein lecha adam b'Yisrael she'en lo golim. Kol zaman shelo kul b'nei Yaakov she'karov karov kodem. You have up to the time of Yaakov, the very nature of all of our genealogy. And trust me, you're related. From time immemorial, we were one family. So there is obviously family that you can go after. Ela, what is the case really talking about in the Torah? Begezel hager hakatuv midaber. It's the case where someone stole from a convert. Vis-a-vis that verse over there in Numbers. Turn 69A1. Va'ama rachamana ish. And the merciful one stated, right, rachamana is a name of God. Ha-rachaman. Right? The aleph at the end being the hey in the Aramaic. Ha-rachaman, rachamana. So there are people who understand Harachamana as the Torah. The way that we think of Rachamana in the Gemara is really the Rachaman, the merciful one, told us in Torah. Vama Rachamana Ish, the merciful one stated in the Torah the extra word man, which connotes an adult. Because what did it say in our verse? Back to the handout. Ve'im ein la'ish goel. It could have just said ve'im ein goel. It didn't have to use the word la'ish. I don't have a single letter, a single word in Torah that's extra. I know I can learn something from the fact that it's there. That means, obviously, an adult. From here, we derive the following law. Ish atah tzarich lachazor alav im yesh lo goelim. A person of legal status, we have to chase after the fact of whether or not he has relatives to whom you have to pay this debt if he's died. Ve'im lav, and if not, then what? You don't have to. Or there's another way to read that sentence. Im atah tzarich lachazor alav im yesh lo goelim ve'im lav. It says the word ish because you have to figure out whether or not you have to go and chase after the relatives of this legal adult. Katan, but a katan, person in the status of a minor who's not fully required by law, you don't have to go investigate whether or not there are relatives to actually find out if you have to pay anybody. Biyadua she'ein lo goelim, because it's known that he has no relatives, and restitution then is payable to whom? The Kohen. And this proves, according to Rabbah, what? That a minor can't father a child. How does it prove that a minor can't father a child?
Because you don't need to look for his descendants to pay restitution.
Exactly. We don't say that he has any possible descendants. So what's the case? What happened to the Ger Katan? By the way, what does it prove about the notion of Gerut and conversion?
So you can convert even as a minor.
You can convert as a minor. And from here we actually get the case of many times a family will come and say, we've had this baby, we adopted this baby, or we've had a baby and we're from this kind of marriage and we really want this child to be part of the Jewish people and go through the solidifying events of the conversion process. Can you help us? And we take the little ones and we go right to the mikveh, whether the child is a couple of days old or a couple of months or a couple of years. And even before bar mitzvah we can do it and then have them re-submerge in the mikveh at bar mitzvah time to affirm from their own set of mindful kind of acceptances and acceptance of the commandments that they are indeed part of the Jewish people. So that's A, and B, that it obviously proves to them that he's got no one, that he died and he's got no one and you don't have to go chasing.
It says if, not since. So if this Ger doesn't have children, but
if the Ish doesn't have children, making clear that it's about an ish, a full status of adult, but it definitely is not about katan.
And it doesn't include the minor's parents because he's a ger, and so because his parents wouldn't be Jewish.
Right. So the other piece that we also see here is that it doesn't include his parents. Doesn't include other family members who are not part. Now, the question asked could be, what if he had a sister who was of age, or a brother who was of age, who converted as well?
But, so it's also saying that you don't have to repay a loan to somebody who's not Jewish?
Basically,
yes. It's basically saying if that's, in that specific case where it's a ger tzedek, and he dies, and there's a guy who borrowed money, and he swore to it that he didn't owe him, and then he came back and said, I really want to make restitution. You know, so there's a little bit more to it than you don't have to pay him back money, because it's a case where there's this kind of double falsehood. I deny it and then I swear that I don't owe him. Which I think is important by way of just noting in general terms sometimes that they're looking for specific cases to delimit again the possibility that we make generalized legal assumption.
Here the borrower is paid. He's paid back.
Yeah, but that's after he changes his mind.
He's decided, well, all of this is about it. The borrower decides he wants to pay back.
So then the minor can have property, and therefore the minor has to have made a loan.
Oh, that's another piece. That's yet another piece that we can learn out of this. There is a certain category of property rights that a minor can have within our tradition and our tradition system. Now, you can't exactly have the same rights as a full-out adult, but you do get a certain amount of rights vis-a-vis property ownership as a minor, and especially when you're an orphan minor. Right, so if you have a parent who dies and leaves you a certain amount of nechatsim, a certain amount of chattel, a certain amount of property, you have to be given that right by the community. This is the way, actually, that our community protected children and didn't make it go to any one centralized, if you will, royal treasury, let's say. So, yes, we learned that as well. And we see that in action, illustrative of our system. So, again, why are we hanging here? We're hanging here because we want to question this view that a minor cannot father a child. So the Gemara is going to even go further. Etive Abaye. Abaye now wants to challenge Rabba's view from a Braita. Now, how do we know it's going to be a Braita? What's the code word? Etive. Ish, the scripture states, and if a man lies carnally with a woman, and she is a slave woman who has been designated to a man, okay, guys, you got to know another story in order to hold with the legal arguments of the Gemara. Back to the handout. So, here you have a situation in Vayikra in Leviticus where you have a story of a woman who's basically stuck between two spots. She's neither totally free, and she's not a full slave. She happens to be betrothed, so she's becoming free. But the ish ki ish kav et isha shichvat zera, the ish shivcha necherefet le ish v'hafde lo nifdeta o chufsha lo nitana bikoret yeh lo yumtu ki lo chupasha. If a man has carnal relations with a woman who is a slave and has been designated for another man but has not been redeemed or given her freedom yet, there shall be an indemnity. They shall not, however, be put to death, since she has not been freed. 21. Vehevi et ashamo ladonai el petach o el moed el asham. He must bring to the entrance of the tent of meeting as his guilt offering to the Lord a ram of guilt offering. So, what do we have here? Again, what word do we hear? Ish. The ish. We also see ki yishkav et isha. He who lays carnal relations, shichvat zera. He has a full ejaculation. Shichvat zera. So it's really carnal knowledge. It's happening. It was this kind of, well, what do we say? She's not totally free yet, and she's pledged to somebody else. Is it Eish and Eish? Is it adultery in its entirety yet? This is a very strange status in the law. But it is a time when it said Eish, a full of majority person, who had carnal intercourse with this woman, who had an ejaculation. So come back to the Gemara. Eitzavei Abaye. Abaye now challenges Rabba's view that a minor can father a child. Ish, it says in our story that an ish, when he lies carnally with the woman, ainli ela ish. From here I know that only this verse discusses an adult man who cohabited with this designated slave woman who's not yet fully redeemed and freed and made available to him. Ben Tesha. Now, we have a braita, a Tana Edic teaching. Ben Tesha shanim v'yom echad sheraui levi'ah minayin. But if a boy who's 9 years old and one day, who's capable of cohabitation, cohabited with her, from where do I know that the laws of this verse apply? So what's the assumption? that a 9-year-old in a day can have a what? A shichvat zera. Can have a full intercourse, including the spilling of seed. Talmud Lomar, the Ish, scripture therefore states, and a man, and that teaches that these laws also apply to the cohabitation of a 9-year-old boy. Now the verse clearly discusses a cohabitation in which the woman was inseminated. Right? So obviously, if we see that a 9-year-old boy is capable of inseminating a woman and thus fathering a child, it refutes Rabba's assertion. It refutes the notion that he can't. And Abaye has this Tanaitic teaching. So don't tell me that this minor can't be termed a category of a person who has this kind of carnal relations. Rabba now responds. He's going to prove that the Braita doesn't prove that a minor can have children. Again, Rabba responds. This is not, by the way, Abaye and Rabba. This is not the famous pair. This is Abaye and Rabba, who also are put into dialogue. Right? He's going to prove to you that the Braita that Abaye brought does not prove the point that a minor can indeed sire children. How's he going to do that? He's going to say, Amar le, Rabba says to Abaye, Yeshlo ve'eno molid. A 9-year-old boy indeed has sperm, or what we call semen, and even may have some sperm, but can't father a child with it. Kitvu'a shelo hevia shlishtami. It's like seeds produced by grains that haven't even grown to a third of their way. And by the way, if you harvest them and you dry them and you plant them and you put them in the earth, nisht. You have nothing. And therefore, this 9-year-old that you're talking about, that's not a person who's moly. That's not a person who can physically have children. And you've proven nothing. Now, what I think is beautiful in terms of that answer is that there's a certain moving towards the outside world, the natural world, the world of nature, to understand our own development in the whole notion of how creation unfolds. It says in Devarim, because this is not an expression that you find in Torah, but it says in Devarim, in another place, Ki ha'adam etz ha'sadeh. A person is like the tree of a field. To kind of give you some type of norming when it comes to attacking a city, besieging it, and leaving certain fruit trees. They've done nothing to you. Don't do to them. It's an example used within this kind of warfare that is part of nature. And it's an example brought from the world of nature to talk about, metaphorically, how you're to relate to the surroundings, what's going on. In order to relate to the surroundings, to what's going on within the procreation, the world of procreation, the world of fathering children, the world of family building, what's the obvious go-to place? Nature. Obviously, they're close agriculturally, and we can say that it's a metaphor that was grounded in a way that isn't even grounded today. In literary theory, we have what's called anchored metaphors. Carlo Ginzburg talks about grounded metaphors in literary theory. What are grounded metaphors? For a Californian, the world shook like an earthquake. Little less grounded, and no pun intended, by the way. Little less grounded for someone who's never experienced either the rock and the roll, or the up and the down, or the shake. But still somewhat grounded, because we've all been on those rides that either shake or a car. Carlo Ginzburg says about metaphors that try to describe the severity of evil of the Holocaust, because he's writing in terms of limits of representation, that it's very difficult to ground a metaphor for people who were not witnesses nor experienced the great Asson, the great disaster, the great Shoah, the Holocaust itself. Here, they use a metaphor that's very grounded for people. Grounded in such a way to say, don't tell me that a 9-year-old can bear, because it's like the grain that we all tried to plant with that's only a third of the way cooked, and therefore it doesn't work. And by the way, I'll even prove to you through language of the Torah that it's really not cooked. The Gemara cites the next braita on the same principle, Tevei Chizkiya Tana, the house of Chizkiya taught the following, Vichi Yazidish, if a man will act intentionally, meaning from this kind of language of acting intentionally when he basically goes to kill this fellow person, Ish Mezid Umazriya, a man's body cooks sperm. The Ein Katan Mezid Umazriya, but a minor's body does not cook sperm and impregnate with it. So the intentionality of one's body becomes the answer to the metaphor we can all understand. If you really aren't going to accept my metaphor from the world of nature, I'll even prove to you from the language of Torah that intentional impregnation can't happen within that boy's body because it's not a time of intentionality and cooking that a boy's body does. So whether you're going to argue from the anatomical and physical reality of human development, or you're going to just take it on my word metaphorically that he's not all the way there, it's like the grain that hasn't completely grown, I have a linguistic proof and I have an agricultural metaphor that works to explain the reality of our physical world and the procreation that God implanted within it. So that's where we're holding.
Thank you.
Does a minor who has a son have an obligation to have a verse for the son?